Hi, this is Debbie.
This is Jackie. In this episode, AADL talks to novelist Steve Amick. Steve grew up in Ann Arbor and is now raising a young family in his hometown. Steve talks to us about his writing life and the decision to return to Ann Arbor. We also talked about his connection to Argus Camera in his old West Side neighborhood and how it became an important element in his second novel, Nothing But a Smile. Tell us about Steve.
Well, I grew up in Ann Arbor, born here in 1964, and went to Huron and really discovered a lot of reading from this library and the branches of this library. It was the kind of place that I could escape to within my own family. They had to have no idea what adventure I was on in the same room with them when all the hectic sibling stuff might be going on. I could be reading many things that probably my parents had no idea I was reading. So I want to thank you guys for that. Then I went away to college and returned eventually in my 30s and have been living here since. And I've published two novels with Random House, The Lake, the River, and The Other Lake, and Nothing But a Smile. Plus I've had some plays in Chicago and published some short stories in magazines.
Tell us why you came back to Ann Arbor.
Well, my parents still live here. And at that point, I was making a living. I was supporting my writing as a freelance copywriter and doing pretty well at it. I got a Clio the first 6 months trying it out. So I was able to kind of work from wherever. And I realized I was closing my apartment in New York during the summer and just going up north. And I might as well live here. And my girlfriend at the time got a job at Borders. So we just moved back. And I've decided when I got here that Michigan began creeping back into my work. And at the same time, whether for that reason or just coincidentally, my work began to become more realistic and also more published. And so I decided that, this place that I had been kind of avoiding creatively for a long time was getting reactions from editors that, it's very exotic, writing about up north or just even writing about places that were probably Ann Arbor. It was unique to them because I was writing it in a very realistic, believable way. And, what you find mundane is often exotic to other people. So this is my place creatively as well as historically.
When did you start writing and what was your first writing?
I think it may have gone back a little bit before this, but the part I distinctly remember, and I've told this story before, but so forgive me, but when I was in the seventh grade, a wonderful teacher who's still here in Ann Arbor, Jan Newman at Tappan, gave an assignment based on The Lady and the Tiger, and I wrote what I thought was a smart aleck answer. And when she called me into her little office, I thought I was in trouble. And I really did. And she said, no, I want to read this to the class. It was, is it the lion or the tiger behind the thing? And in my little seventh grade mind, I made it the Avon lady. And he took an order for tiger shampoo and princess bath beads or something. And then it would be arriving in 2 weeks. And that was the end of my little ending of the story. And I thought I was in trouble. And she said, you need to be a writer. And I was doing that at that time. I was writing short stories in English classes, and they were being submitted to the Scholastic Writing Contest. Also in high school, Stan Bidlack at Huron really took me under his wing and said, seriously, you need to do this. Get an MFA. This is what you're going to do if you want to do this. And so I was doing it probably 12 to 13. I was writing stories and planning to become a writer. And now I kind of wish I'd had a little more ping-ponging around, but that was the trajectory from an early stage.
How was that received by your family? Did they appreciate your talent, your siblings?
I don't think it was odd in my family to want to do something slightly different, and at the time it was. I mean, when I got at my MFA, there were 30 programs in America, now there are 150. But the oddness wasn't a problem. you know, I'm sure my parents were proud of me. There were four kids, and it's hard to sort of – there wasn't a lot of doting on anybody. But I come from a family of kind of weirdos. So, I mean, my brother played the bagpipes, and my sister is in the Forest Service, and, you know, I think it was appreciated. But my mom read to us. She was a school teacher before she had us. But other than that, I didn't see a lot of adults reading novels in my family. I wasn't around it that way. We were read it to as kids, and then it was something for me to do to avoid paying attention during the family car trips. To be removed. but it wasn't modeled for me. I didn't have professor parents or anything like that.
But you had some good mentors in school.
Yeah, I did. And I'm sure it was appreciated by my parents, but it wasn't something that I was modeling from them.
Tell us about these car trips. Were they painful?
Besides books, I read a lot of Uncle Scrooge comic books, I think. I sort of remember, oh yeah, we went, when I saw the, they were painful. And eventually I learned to be just terrible enough that I was finally not required to participate. So, I will ruin this trip. And then, you know, my dad told me at one point, you know, you told me that and I didn't believe you, but you're right.
Did the up north start with your parents in those trips, or did the up north happen on your own?
No. That goes back to the 30s in my family. We have a piece of property up north that was quite large at the time when it was there was one motorboat in the area, and it was with my family, and often the large parts of the summer, a couple summers it was the whole summer, so it was a large part of my upbringing, and it was also a large part of my reading and writing and thinking about stories, because we didn't have TV or telephone up there, and you had to sort of self-entertain. So that was wonderful. There was one summer I was in the sixth grade or something, I read the complete works of O. Henry, taken out of this very library, 1,400 pages or something. And I think it kind of ruined my storytelling for about into grad school even. And then the ending, you know. So I was doing that well into my 20s because of this book that I read. I remember up at the cottage for the whole summer, just hearing story after story that ended with a surprise ending.
Now, your first novel, The Lake, The River, and The Other Lake, is set in northern Michigan. Is that based on your experience?
It's based on my love for the summer up there and that sort of thing. But it is really not I'm no good with foreign words, but Roman clay or anything like that. It doesn't have a direct translation to anything in my life other than my love for our lake and our cottage. But it doesn't. There's not people that I know. I don't really know people up there. We sort of stayed where we were. And geographically, it doesn't really match up to anything in particular. It's sort of an amalgam. It's like Charlevoix Bridge. And if you triangulate, it's Manistee. But I'd never really spent much time there until I started doing readings for the Michigan Notable Book. So it's a number of places kind of combined.
See, that's one of the favorite pastimes of us up northers, is we get around together and we argue about which lake you're talking about. And we all name the lake that we hang out.
Well, I'll tell you the problem. The problem is trying to serve two things, especially at the time that this book came out. A new novelist was required by the bigger publishers to show something biographical about themselves that would validate, because of the rise of the memoir and things like that, that would validate their writing about that subject. So if someone was a waitress for a long time and it was about being a waitress, they would put that heavily in their bio, and they would even do interviews with the publisher about it and stuff like that. So they really wanted to put that, you know, well, he lives in Ann Arbor, but he also, you know, he grew up a lot up north and they have this family cottage. And then I have a family that's very modest and private in general, and specifically about the property we have. And then on top of that, some even, you know, want to disassociate from my work. So I had to put a cryptic kind of thing in my bio, and it unfortunately created this thing where people thought, oh, so he's hiding the you know. And I've read in communities where they're at little libraries for for the Michigan Notable Book, especially because they put you in small towns where I've never been, and they're telling me, this is about this place, isn't it? And I'm like, you know, well, I got here a half an hour ago, so.
No, we're convinced up in Frankfort, Beulah that.
Yeah, I went to Frankfort for the first time. For the second Michigan Notable Book, I stopped in on my way up north, and it was wonderful. And I thought, you know, this would be a good place to shoot a movie of the book. And I went to I went by the bookstore, and it was in the window 5 years later. They said they sell this book all the time here. Like, this is their book for this town. And I thought, that's great. But, you know,
so everybody should
I'm
think.
I'm here for 5 minutes. I have a map. You know, I can look at a map. But no, I know. I think the interesting thing about that book was I did a radio call-in show when it first came out in hardcover out of Indiana or Illinois. It was some minor NPR show, and they got a call from Jackson Hole, Wyoming. A guy there said he was reading the book and he loved it because it reminded him so much of Jackson Hole in the winter, you know, when all the skiers come in. And then they, I think it was that show, they had people call in with the different names like Fudgy from their area. And there's something in Pennsylvania around the Poconos that has to do with pretzels or something. And so there's a derogatory term for these tourists who are sort of instrumental in the economy but are derided as well because they're somewhat abusive to the social fabric. So all around the country, apparently, there are names that are equivalent of Fudgies and stuff. That was wonderful to hear that about the guy from Jackson Hole who thought that book was really significant to him. And I think that's the same case within Michigan, is that – but I that, you know, people react to it because it's a basic kind of idea of insiders and outsiders that are driving the economy in a small town.
Now, you talk about where you want to set the film, if it's going to be produced. Is that something coming?
No, I had a very lucrative option, and I was the consultant, though I was not consulted to do anything. The most I did was I sent the producer a very nice cherry pie from up north on his birthday, which apparently he appreciated a lot. There was a package deal that a producer, director, screenwriter, Gary David Goldberg, who did Sit Ubu Sit. He's a Family Ties and Spin City, and then unfortunately he did right prior to this he did Must Love Dogs. And I think that
Claire Cook's book.
Yeah, that movie became the substitute punchline. It replaced Ishtar with stand-up comedians. That's what I noticed, at least. I don't know. But what I heard was he was with my book one summer in his Vermont cabin, and he was working on translating it to a screenplay. And I think he was reading it and rereading it. And then soon after that, he announced he wasn't going to make movies anymore. He was basically retiring. And he had a memoir about Michael J. Fox or working with him or something. And he decided that he was going to just write books. And my agent and I joked that, you know, he sat down with my book and looked at it closely enough and figured, like, I can do this, you know, so I'll just write books. This looks easy when I really look at it. So anyway, that all fell through before the tax code thing, before we even had that option. And I really feel that this would have to be filmed in Michigan. And the Michigan people that were putting that law together came around to readings and would ask me how the deal was going and stuff. But at the time that we had the deal, there was no way to film in Michigan. And I think that if the timing had been better, if it had been a little bit later, a year later, he might have been able to get enough money and interest to put it together.
Now, do the options come back to you? Do you regain rights to
your
own?
Before that, I turned down a TV deal that would have basically just been Northern Exposure. I felt that that even a year or two of storyline would overpower someone's perception of the characters.
So it was supposed to be a series and not like a movie made for television.
No, like more like a Northern Exposure, a quirky town with people doing things over and over. And I just thought the TV version of Roger, the TV version of all these von Buschberger would become larger in people's minds than the character. And if I ever wanted to return to them, it would be difficult. And I just didn't like the deal. I thought one time, you get the movie wrong, that's fine. People say, oh, the movie isn't the book, whatever. But if it's this thing that goes on, it didn't seem the right way to do it.
Do you have plans to go back to those characters?
I possibly. Also, there are storylines that I removed from the original manuscript, which is frustrating when I hear people say, oh, this part doesn't feel finished or something, that I was convinced to cut some of them out. There are whole storylines that could be novellas, basically. It was about 525, and I think when we sent it to the publisher, it was about 425. Maybe 90 pages were cut.
You know, every time up north when we hear a buzzsaw going, we look around and we immediately think of the book.
Oh, because the neighbor cutting the trees. The neighbor cutting the trees is the only thing that I consciously lifted from real life. But I took it from my friend.
That's what I wanted to ask.
Yeah, I took it from my friend who lives on the Connecticut River in Connecticut, and he's a lawyer, and he said those things to his neighbor. I shouldn't say this. But he said, you know, I could sue you all day long. Just you need to replace those trees. I can do it for free. I can just go down to the courthouse and sue you all day long. And he was right. The guy said that he, you know, his family had been there for 100 years, and so he had somehow the right to keep looking at the river, and the trees had grown up. So he cut my friend's trees down. So that's the only thing that I consciously lifted from real life.
But it's a great fear of the people that live up there that they're going to hear the buzzsaw, and all of a sudden,
yeah,
a lot of trees that they've treasured and that they're showing their grandchildren aren't there anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I think it's kind of a universal thing.
Well, let's talk about Nothing But a Smile.
Okay.
Why World War II and why Chicago?
Boy, I have to think back here. World War II, I remember consciously making this decision. A lot of this book was written it came pretty quickly for a number of reasons. The real strong growth of the beginning of these kind of this kind of cheesecake photography was a little bit later, and I knew that when I started. I looked at there's this one reference book. This did exist at this time, and in the places that I described, and with Yank and Stars and Stripes and places like that, and some of these smaller magazines that I described are real magazines that came out of New York. Mostly from one publisher. But of course, the time you really think of is the 50, I can't remember the exact date, but a couple years later, when you see the beginning of Playboy and that very early, you know, all in an apartment being pasted together. But around that time, it was a couple years later that it really flourished. I felt that to raise the stakes for normal people put in a position where they need to make a little money, to raise the stakes, you need to add, you need to pile on. And so to pile on, I moved it immediately. I said, it's much more imperative that someone make a living and keep the home fires burning during the home front years. And I was always very intrigued by the World War II home front. There was only one thing that I remember really strongly being about that was a TV show in the early 90s. It ran for about 2 years. It spawned a lot of famous actors, but it was a network show called Homefront, and it was based on. I think it started at the end of World War II, but it had to do with the housing crunch and you know, women's role in the workplace after being in the factories and the dislocation of women in those jobs, the sudden. Interaction of the races that occurred because of World War II, and all those social issues were covered on it. It was an ensemble show that was, I thought, pretty wonderful. And at the end, they'd end with a real newsreel from the era that had some kind of juxtaposition. So anyway, that show was one of the few places I saw that really addressed that. You have all these documentaries about World War II, but you don't, and some now about production, Rosie the River and stuff like that. But you don't see a lot about the rationing and things like that. The stuff that we've been accused of now of not doing, and obviously we don't do in terms of wartime, but I would hear these stories from my mom and my dad about scraping the tinfoil off the gum wrappers you're going to make a tank out of that. Or collecting cattail fluff for life jackets and those kind of shortages and rations and all that civilian interaction with the war effort is fascinating to me. So for those reasons, it went there. And then Chicago was the heart of this it was the nexus of both careers that Wink has. The packaged goods, because of the packaged goods industry, the kind of basic bread and butter advertising was happening very strongly in Chicago, and it was also a big publishing town. So those two things. It's where you had Gil Elfgren's type calendar with pinup art being produced as sort of a subsidiary of advertising, and so he was it was the place for both of those things.
Now, did you do very much research on the time period, or you?
Yeah, I did, but I also knew a lot about it. You know, a lot of it is that you start out and you think, is that what that was? And you go and look it up, and it was. And people are kind of baffled by that sometimes, but I'm not an historian, but I guess I was just raised that way, or I've always had that interest, and I retain a lot about that. I was interested in being a cartoonist when I was young. Bill Malden is mentioned in here. And when I was maybe 10 or 11, I was very important for me to go to – he was lecturing at the EMU, and I needed to go meet him because I already – you know, I had – some of his books from World War II, and I have an autograph from Bill Malden. He was a little puzzled that an 11-year-old knew who he was. So a lot of it was that, and then you know I did some research. Usually get the story going and then double check it, fact check it. I was rarely wrong when I got to that point, I have to say, and that's largely because I think I made a choice from the beginning that it wasn't going to be. That it was going to be a real people-focused story, and that it was going to feel that, you know, it wasn't going to be driven by the research. It's tricky to do. You read that sometimes in real strict historical fiction. You see, oh, they're showing off their research. You know, the story suddenly has to tell you all about the way some widgets are made or something, and it's purely because the writer has decided that, you know, this was fascinating, and they took a long time learning this, and so you have to sit there and listen to it. And it's not really the world of those characters at that moment or what they care about. So there's not, you know, it feels to me like a play almost, because they seem to be sort of in a, not a bubble, but they're in a very concise world without a lot of explanation. I also, one reason was I knew I didn't have the time to do sort of a Cavalier and Clay version of pinups, that it wasn't going to be an industry, a history of the industry. That would be a great book. And I considered it for a moment, you know, and I considered it being about two guys after World War II who basically launch a career that turns into something like Playboy. And I considered it for about 5 minutes and thought that's not the way to go with this. This is a love story. This is people trying to do the best they can do in a really hard moment, you know, not a long lifetime.
Does Argus come in at the very beginning? Did you know that you were going to introduce?
I did not set out to introduce Argus. You know, growing up in Ann Arbor, I have some vague understanding of its importance in the town, or that, you know, it was a camera company, and that was sort of in my head. But I did know from the beginning that the characters were going to things were going to become untenable for the characters, or it's not interesting in the kind of in a simplistic story. It's and that they were going to end up in a more domestic place outside of the city. Some people have written that it's describing the, you know, social movements to the suburbs and all that, and it wasn't really in the front of my head either. It's just when you put characters in the real world situation, they often do what people historically did, because that's the logical thing to do. So I knew that they were going to end up in sort of a suburban situation, and I had the glimmer of what is the sort of flash forward at the beginning of the book. There's a prologue where we see Sal quite elderly and being moved out of a house. So I had some idea of that. In my mind, it was probably the western side of the state or Indiana. And I got as far as some spoilers here for the story. As far as Wink learning learning the camera, when I started thinking about, okay, what camera is he going to have? Wink is disabled, and he's trying to relearn both his creative side, his art, and a career. He was an artist, a painter and drawer or illustrator. And he's rehabilitating and learning photography. And when I got to the idea of what is the camera that he begins to work on, it needed to be something that was that his friend, who was a professional photographer, would have and might be using in the field in World War II, and something that was someone with a little bit of manual problems might be able to handle if one of his hands is not working quite as well. And something that you could both learn on and be amateurish and learn, something easy to operate, but of professional quality that he could begin to do professional work. And when I just did the preliminary, cheesy kind of research, just looking online, everything started hitting me, Argus. And then I started thinking, well, that's right here. And that's the building I go by with my infant, we go for walks and strolls, and you have these happy accidents as a writer where you don't want to be led by the research, but when things start kind of knocking and saying hello, you start to think, wait a minute, well, so Ann Arbor, and when it came time for them to escape Chicago, essentially, that's why the story. Again, I'm giving away some of the book, but that's why the story ended up being Ann Arbor, not Kalamazoo or Indiana or anything like that, because of this nice tie-in with Argus that I could then see him beginning. And there's glimmers you get at the end that, there is some work done with Argus eventually. It's just too perfect to not have it go that way. So when you get little signs, you kind of have to follow them. And that to me was a sign. And then when I did further research, I found that it really was the right camera for him. It made a lot of sense.
Do you have an Argus camera?
I do not have one. But I could see also from this character, I think that it would really appeal to him, that the artist, the hand quality of it, the ergonomics of it. As an artist, I think it's such a beautiful object. At one point we were looking for, we really struggled with covers for a long time. They had some really elaborate things that I turned down. And at one point I sent them pictures of the C3 and said, look at this thing. I mean, you could tip it sideways, it'd be the whole cover. I mean, it's just an amazing object. And they were considering that. It was a happy accident. My experience with photography has been the process of taking a photography class all through school, college, learning the darkroom, and then forgetting it after that semester. And just the science and chemistry aspect is always baffling to me. But, I retain some of that idea, depth of field and those kind of things. I'm not really a photographer by any stretch of the imagination. But the perfectness of making it right there where I walk down the street almost every other day was too irresistible. And then I think it did create a really nice conclusion.
Do you want to read?
Yeah, maybe I could read a couple little snippets that do mention the Argus. I guess I should set this up a little. This is a spoiler. Sally is giving her recently deceased husband his camera to Wink, his best friend, who's learning photography. And I should say, too, that I don't know for sure that I know it had Bakelite in it, possibly. I don't know for sure that the C3 would survive through the explosion that I described, but that was the idea. She gave him the Argus. It was the C3 for 35mm, the popular model folks called the brick, on account of it was no bigger than one, really. And Chesty's favorite, too, she said. Fits in your hand pretty nicely, huh? Wonderful, he said, hefting it. She pointed out, in case he didn't know, that it was made in Michigan, and he gave her a grin, saying, as if I needed anything more to recommend it, it being Chesty's personal favorite and all. She reminded him they wouldn't know if it was damaged until they got home and developed the film. But either way, she said, even if it's a paperweight, I want you to have it. He'd be so glad you're doing what you're doing now, moving forward, trying new things. She seemed to choke a little saying it. And then later, when they're driving around Ann Arbor for the first time looking for a new home, they're looking at a possible shop, retail space to start another camera shop. The retail space they were considering was on a street called Liberty back downtown. While looping around to make another pass by it from the other direction, but still smack in the residential section, the bright masonry of the Argus Camera Company headquarters suddenly appeared before them as if plunked down amid the elms and maples. "Hey," Wink said, "home of the brick. How about that for a sign, boy?" He sounded so peppy about the whole adventure, she wondered if he was putting it on a little thick, if he was actually, in fact, as nervous and scared as she. There's more there. And then the current owner, Joe O'Neill, was wonderful about he let us have the book launch there in the little museum. So that was great. And we had the Royal Garden Trio playing, and we served cheesecake.
What's a typical writing day like for you?
It's going to change in about a month because I've volunteered to take my son to the bus at 7:59 in the morning. So I guess I'll be writing during the day. But I do write during the day, but it often happens at night as well because I do have a child in the house sometimes running around. I get up when I get up. I don't set the alarm, and then I usually do work in the morning some. If I'm not hit by a bunch of awful emails. But I try to work on a number of things at once. That's changing a little bit lately, I guess. I think I'm becoming more focused on one thing at a time. But it used to be that I would work so much, I think, so much of the day that I tried to split it up so that I was working on two or three things, partly because maybe it's a slight ADD thing, which I don't know if I have, but just, you know, trying to keep it fresh. But I think it also might diffuse the disappointment and frustration a little. So if you're you're stuck a little, you can move on to this other thing. So you might work on a novel in the morning a little, and then there's some story idea you had you were working on. And that's the kind of way that I tend to work. I did that a lot with the first book, within the first book, so that when I got to a snag with one character, I could move to the other and deal with their issue. And that moved it along very quickly. In fact, the beginning of that book, I wrote 20 pages a day for the first 10 days, and then I had 200 pages up at our cottage, and then I knew I would be sort of stuck finishing it. That was a crazy schedule. But yeah, I do that. And then now I'm teaching one class with the MFA, the graduate workshop at Northwestern on Saturdays. So I will be going out and teaching in the fall. I did that last year too.
You commute?
Yeah, just drive 4 hours to Chicago. It's to Chicago. It's not, they have a campus there. You don't have to go all the way up to Evanston. It's a little different, a little easier. But it's just, you know, 2 hour class once a week for 10 days, 10 weeks. It's a, yeah, but I'd say that mostly I write during the day now, in the morning and the afternoon, with additional add-ons in the middle of the night. But I have an office in the house, and it's relatively quiet.
Do you belong to a writing group? Who do you bounce your ideas off of?
I don't really have anybody anymore. I did that for many years in grad school, and one of my good friends died a few years ago. We did read stories sometimes. I don't do it that often. I'm starting to be asked by some other people, other writers that you would recognize, to read things. And I guess that means I could give them something. So I probably should start doing that. My wife, Cheryl, is a librarian, and she in the school system. And she reads everything. And is a pretty good reader, but for the most part, I'm a little bit in needing that right now. I'm sort of in a spot where I don't have a good peer reader right now.
But does she read your drafts?
Yeah. Well, I try to get things a little bit finished before she reads them, mostly because you know, it's harder and harder for her to have time to do it now with our son Huck running around.
Do you have a favorite writer or writers growing up? besides O. Henry that I'm...
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I kind of hope that it's not reflected in my work now. But growing up, the usual kind of young rebellious people, I mean, young people go to feel rebellious, like Vonnegut and those people, Kerouac, I was into all those things that you don't see in my work at all. Lately, I like Ron Carlson a great deal, and he's sort of a go-to guy. He's a writer's writer now. Like, a lot of writers know of him, and I don't know if that many readers know of him. But I'm a big fan of his work.
So what are you reading right now?
What am I reading right now?
Do you read much nonfiction?
I do in the process of writing. I'm reading a lot of stuff. I'm working on expanding a story about Harry Bennett that was in the Ghostwriters book, which was a Michigan Notable Book Award winner last year. It was an anthology of Michigan writers writing contemporary ghost stories. It was also in the Cincinnati Review, and I think it's going to be in the back of Best American, one of the also-rans, in the next month. And I've expanded that significantly. So I'm reading a lot of stuff about Ann Arbor and other places that people don't know that Harry Bennett was. And it's fascinating. But I'm reading, I wonder if I should say this, I'm reading Don Lystra's short story collection that's not published yet, but is really good. And I think it'll be out the beginning of next year.
He's a local writer, right?
He is. I think he is in Ann Arbor, if not Chelsea or Dexter. That's really good.
Well, you do a lot of things, sounds like. You write at night. What else do you do besides writing?
I used to play music, but I'm not so much now that we have a five-year-old. And art. And I'm trying to get more into that. I'm being encouraged to try to illustrate some of the children's book ideas I have that we're trying to send out. And I sort of inadvertently illustrated my first novel. Wasn't really the plan, but I do that sort of thing. Up until the new law about fireworks, I was a big fireworks buff. And this law is just ruining it. We bought a piece of property out where we had 3.5 acres and we call Reckless Manor, because we probably shouldn't have bought it. But let's just buy a big place we can't afford. But it was the land, and it goes out into the gravel pit. And so basically I bought a fireworks proving ground. So my five-year-old would come home from preschool, put on the welding helmet and say, like, you know, Dad, let's throw up some shells. And then we would go out and just, you know, do some mortars and aerial shells. And now this new law has come along, and I just feel like I'm one of the jackasses that's, hurting things and themselves. And the solution now is going to be that a lot of townships and things will ban the use of fireworks. They used to be perfectly legal. You just had to have the energy to go to Porter, Indiana. And so now it's actually going to be – you'll be less free to do these things. But anyway, that was kind of my fun – that was one of my fun hobbies up until maybe this summer.
Did you design the cover? Was that something you had in mind?
That's another question too, because I did get very aggressive about the covers they had. I would say, like, that underwear is wrong for that era.
We know it's World War II, and we know it's in Chicago. Advertising. Why pinup girls?
Okay, so I think it was January 1st, 2007. I was looking for a calendar for the year, and I had been talking to my father-in-law, who was a graphic artist and commercial illustrator in advertising and in other things in Chicago. And he had been talking, he had just been to visit, and he'd been talking about Gil Elfgren, who's an artist that I admire, who's known for his pinup calendars from that era, the very sort of wholesome-looking pinup calendars. And also for the Coke Santas, he took over on the Coke Santas. And my father-in-law was saying prior to Christmas, was saying, yeah, Gil Elfgren was the guy that we all – that's the guy we all wanted to be. And he said, I blew it. I had a chance to study painting with him 1 year, and I didn't do it. And I regret that. And we all – that was the guy. And so I was looking at calendars to get in a calendar, and I was remembering what my father-in-law said. And my father-in-law also overnight basically had been diagnosed with terminal cancer, and he was about to start chemo and was kind of checking out emotionally. So I was looking at those and thinking about him, maybe getting him a calendar, Gil Elfgren, getting myself one, whatever, and came across this non-Gil Elfgren, like retro, weird, homemade-looking pinup photo, a calendar of these sort of obscure, unknown 1950s early cheesecake photos, and I found this photo that was this woman lying. It has to be a basement, but there's a sun painted on the wall, and the sun has binoculars and is checking her out and grinning, and she just looks very kind of wholesome, even though she's naked and reading the newspaper and has a, I don't know if that's a page boy. Anyway, it's very retro looking, and as a joke, I saved the picture and put a title on it called The Girlies, you know, a novel by Steve Amick. And I put it in a file just for inspiration someday. Oh, and told myself someday I'll attempt to write a book with this title. And I got it sort of crawled in the back of my head. The next day, between that inspiration and thinking I wanted to work on something that I could have to monkey around with. Once my son was born, my son was about to be born in 3 months. I didn't know it was a son, but we were going to have a kid in 3 months, and I wouldn't be able to do and be invested in anything with any focus after about 2 months. So I was looking for something that I could really throw myself into. And also, my father-in-law, I thought this would be a good thing I could ask him questions about. So I did that. I began this thing that day, and it began The Girlies. And I wrote 5 pages a day for the next 2 months, and I had the manuscript after 2 months. And during that time, I also would call my father-in-law, who was sometimes otherwise pretty out of it from chemo and stuff. And I heard that he really was looking forward to this book, and he knew about it. He knew about my son, and he knew about the book, and he didn't see either one in person, but it was something that occupied his mind a little bit, and that was kind of my hope. So I would ask him about In the Loop at this time, what was going on here, or what kind of we didn't have in-depth amounts of research, but it was interesting to fact check a few things with him and get him thinking about the idea of it. He really liked the idea of this book, so that's how I put him in the dedication in the front of the book.
Music for this episode was Strolling by Alan Machan off his Blues for All Occasions album, which you can find on the AADL catalog by going to aadl.org/magnitudes. AADL Talks to Steve Amick has been a production of the Ann Arbor District Library.